I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas' 2nd Congressional District has been reliably conservative for the last decade, but an established Democrat on the ticket facing off with an unfamiliar Republican candidate has some wondering if this is the cycle that flips the district. Today, we'll ask GOP insiders about their candidate, Steve Watkins, and speak to State House reporters about Paul Davis, who could be Kansas Democrats' next big hope. Then, it's the return of the film critics. They'll discuss the latest crop of features, including a puzzling love story, high fashion icons, undercover cops, and a secret pimp to Hollywood's rich and famous. You don't want to miss it. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It stretches from Hiawatha in the north all the way to Coffeyville in the south. It picks up Leavenworth and Lawrence and Paola and Topeka in between. Kansas' 2nd Congressional District spans a lot of geographic and ideological terrain. But since the last redistricting nearly a decade ago, one thing's been fairly consistent. Republican Lynn Jenkins was going to win this seat with 57% to 60% of the vote every time. But this year, Jenkins is retiring. The Republican who eked out the nomination to defend the seat, Steve Watkins, has found himself a controversial candidate, with many in his own party questioning his conservative bona fides. Meanwhile, some think the Democrat, former gubernatorial candidate Paul Davis, has a real chance. Joining us to unpack the race is Tim Carpenter. He's the State House Bureau Chief at the Topeka Capital Journal, and he joins us from our Kansas News Service studios in Topeka, across from the Capitol. Tim, good morning.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Strangely enough, the managing director of the Kansas News Service is joining us here in Kansas City, Jim McLean. Hi, Jim.
Hey, hi, Brian. Elegant summary there, by the way.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. We may not even have to have this segment. I want to start with the Republican side of this race, actually, and fill out the picture for me, Jim. Who is Steve Watkins?
Well, as you indicated, he's the guy who won the 2nd District Republican primary with a mere 26% of the vote. Kind of an enigmatic figure, if you will. He's an Army veteran, an adventurer, a mountain climber, and the guy who essentially won that primary with a TV ad blitz that nobody else in the primary could afford, but that Steve could because of a lot of money poured into his campaign by his father. So still a lot not known about this guy. He's only voted apparently once in his life in a city election in Topeka. That was a point of criticism in the primary. So he's a kind of a blank slate, if you will, and I think maybe that's one of the reasons why he prevailed in the primary.
Tim Carpenter, tell us a little more of the picture of that primary. How did Steve Watkins emerge out of nowhere to grab hold of the nomination?
So it was a 7-person primary, and most of the other candidates were pretty established Kansas politicians. Mr. Watkins was the outsider, the anti-establishment candidate. But I do think he broke from the pack because his father poured money into a super PAC, I mean a lot of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars into TV ads and mailers that convinced enough voters, barely enough, to put him on the November ballot.
Well, we've noted that his candidacy, apart from the late infusion of dollars, also caused some consternation because of the candidate himself, and we want to try to understand that, so we've asked a couple of party leaders to join us. Rhett Rogers is the Leavenworth County Republican Party chair. He joins us by phone this morning from Lansing, Kansas. Mr. Rogers, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Cheryl Reynolds. She's the 2nd Congressional District GOP party chair, and she's joining us there also with Tim in Topeka. Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Let me start with you, Rhett Rogers. Your local state senator, Steve Fitzgerald, was one of those 6 unsuccessful candidates for the nomination. He certainly hasn't had much nice to say about Steve Watkins. What did you think of Watkins as the nominee?
Well, Steve's biggest challenge he had is he wasn't known to anybody in Leavenworth. As some of your earlier guests said, is, you know, he came in as the outsider, and he had to get his name out there. His father's money, if you will, did have a lot to do with him getting his name so broadly across the 2nd District. Steve came and talked to us a couple times. I thought he was had a compelling story. He was an interesting person to talk to. But, you know, as you said, there were some things we didn't know about him. You know, I know personally, I know Steve Fitzgerald, I know Karen Tyson, I know Kevin Jones, I know Vernon Fields. I knew the, all those candidates. So it was easier for the party to get behind the people they know.
But I have to say, I mean, the idea that a West Point graduate who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, who's charismatic, who talks tough on immigration, who supports gun rights, you would think that he'd be a really popular figure with Leavenworth County Republicans. Am I wrong about that?
Well, no, you're not wrong about that. It's like I said, the Republicans in Leavenworth County didn't know him. Steve's a vet, served as Special Forces. Kevin Jones is a vet, so they resonated. Those similar type of backgrounds existed for Steve and Kevin, as well as Steve Watkins.
Cheryl Reynolds, obviously you're the district party chair, a pretty significant figure in the county, and you joined with 40 other party leaders, county chairs and others, issuing a statement before the primary, raising concerns about Steve Watkins. What were you concerned about?
I think we were concerned because we didn't know a lot about him. I think about it as kind of a family, and he was the new member of the family, and we really didn't have a lot of information about him. But that was the primary. Now we're in the general, and he's now a full-fledged member of the family. He's reached out. He's made significant efforts to get to know the people that signed that letter, the other county chairs, the other key players in the second district.
Yeah.
And I think you will find that there's a unified backing behind him now.
Right. And obviously you're in a position to be supporting the party's nominee for the district. I guess I'm curious, though, to try to understand kind of how we came to this place, where the questions started. I mean, the questions weren't just whether he was known or not. There were questions about his views on issues like abortion.
Correct. And that's kind of the time that we've been putting in this week. Steve Watkins made himself available to meet with a lot of the people that were concerned, the people that were signatories, and he spent hours answering every question imaginable and really filled in the chinks of our knowledge. And he left both, we had two meetings, he left both of those meetings with the full backing of everybody that was there. It was a case of not having enough information, I agree, but I think he's provided that information now, and we're confident going forward with our nominee.
Jim McLean, the concerns that were voiced before the primary had to do with not being certain that the candidate really was opposed to abortion rights.
Well, that was part of it. And also, there were questions as to whether he was really a Republican. Tim Carpenter at the Capital Journal wrote a story in the primary about him meeting with state Democratic officials and chatting with them about possibly running as a Democrat. And so, you know, and it's completely understandable now that people, officials in the Republican Party are going to be rallying behind their nominee. However, it was a pretty extraordinary thing to have that, you know, all those people come out right before the primary and say, you know, we really have questions about this guy. We don't have questions about the other six candidates. And I can understand the need to heal that rift and for Mr. Watkins to answer the questions to the satisfaction of the people who signed that letter. And yet I'm not sure all those questions have been answered in the minds of some Republicans.
Yeah, Tim Carpenter, I mean, there was some bad blood during the primary, and of course everyone speaks about unity after an election, but does this seem to have hurt Watkins?
So I would imagine that the criticism of Mr. Watkins on several fronts had an effect on his vote total. You know, in addition to the suggestion that he met with Democrats in 2017 and talked about running for Congress as a Democrat, in addition to the county GOP people raising issues with Mr. Watkins' candidacy, you know, it appears like he's perhaps voted once in his life, and that was in 2017 in a municipal election in Topeka. I think he spent much more time in other countries and in other states, Alaska, for example, than he has in Kansas. And so there's questions about his dad's money, and you know, to put it bluntly, is Mr. Watkins more of a carpetbagger politician? Is it a silver spoon from his dad that carried him to victory? There's other issues, questions about his policy depth. He spent a lot of the primary campaign saying, "I love all things Trump. I'm against illegal immigration," and just so there's. I think those policy voids need to be fleshed out, as Ms. Reynolds says in her small group discussion, need to be fleshed out with the general public about where Mr. Watkins stands, because Paul Davis's record over the last 15 years is well known. He's campaigned statewide before, and so Mr. Watkins is a newcomer, and it's incumbent upon him to explain himself, I think.
And we'll talk more about Paul Davis in just a moment, but I guess I want to ask you, Rhett Rogers, in a year when Republicans worry about holding on to every seat, and in a district that does include some pretty strongly Democratic areas, isn't there perhaps some benefit to having a candidate like Steve Watkins who might not be perceived as so conservative, where some of his policy positions might not be as clearly staked out on the conservative side?
Yeah, there's probably a lot of benefit in that. And I'm going to go back to something that Mr. Carpenter had said about Steve visiting with the Kansas GOP. It's kind of interesting, as if you get a military guy and you're interested in learning about your opponents, having an opportunity to talk with them and research them is actually very valuable. His decision to talk with the Kansas Democrat Party is not, to me, a startling thing, learning his opponent. So I think his broader, to answer your question directly, his broader appeal of having a less ossified, if you will, position on certain conservative issues may make him more appealing to some of the more moderate wing of the Republican Party in Kansas.
Cheryl Reynolds, you speak for the whole district. Is that how you see it?
I have perhaps just a little bit different perspective. I think that in talking with Steve over the last few days, I think he is a fairly conservative candidate. I'm not going to try to articulate his policy positions for him. I think that's for him and his campaign to do. But I will say there will be a difference going forward. The primary is the primary. Now in the general, he has a more experienced team behind him. They're going to do a really effective job, I think, of getting his message out. And I think maybe we didn't see as much of that in the primary because there was more of the getting to know who he was type aspect of it and less on the policy. I think he's made an effort to really solidify his policy positions, and I think you're going to be hearing more about that from his campaign going forward.
Jim McLean, in terms of the policy positions that we have heard the candidate articulate, does he seem to be a fairly straightforward, traditional conservative?
Yes, and as was mentioned earlier in the conversation, I think Tim said it, he's tied himself pretty closely to President Trump, and I was in touch with his campaign yesterday to talk about this impeachment issue that people are now talking about and how Democratic candidates are really very much reluctant to talk about it. And again, the Watkins campaign said he's a very firm supporter of the president's, would not vote for impeachment, and he challenged Davis to be more explicit about his position on that. So just from that, the signal that sends to voters, I think he's trying very hard to appeal to that conservative base because, among other things, we shouldn't forget that Donald Trump won the 2nd District pretty handily in the 2016 presidential race. However, Paul Davis also won that district when he ran for governor in 2014. So it looks like it's going to be a pretty interesting contest.
And perhaps more interesting than the last few elections in the 2nd District.
Yeah.
Cheryl Reynolds, before we let you go, are you surprised by the attention that this race and especially your nominee have been receiving? There have been national stories about the Kansas 2nd for the first time in a long time.
No, we weren't surprised because we have known for some time that Paul Davis was going to be the Democratic opponent, and we knew that this race was going to attract national attention, that it was targeted nationally because it was an open seat. So we're not surprised. I don't think it matters who the nominee is. We would have had those national stories.
Rhett, are you optimistic about how this turns out?
Oh, I'm very optimistic. I think that Cheryl said it had it exactly right. That you have your fighting amongst your family, if you will. You have your contest, and family selected somebody, and now they're getting it behind him. I think Leavenworth County is going to strongly back Steve Watkins for the 2nd Congressional District.
Well, that's Rhett Rogers. He's the Leavenworth County Republican Chair, and Cheryl Reynolds is the 2nd District Republican Chair. I want to thank them for being with us today. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you for having us.
And sticking around with me are Jim McLean of the Kansas News Service and Tim Carpenter of the Topeka Capital Journal. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to KCUR's Up to Date. I want to talk about the Democratic candidate in this race. The Democrats seem to think they really have a chance here with Paul Davis. Jim McLean, give us the thumbnail sketch of Davis, the former gubernatorial nominee, as a candidate. What kind of congressional candidate has he turned out to be?
Well, I think he's is probably as good a candidate as the Kansas Democratic Party could offer, particularly for this time and place. He's a former Democratic leader in the Kansas House, and Tim wrote a story just the other day in which he quoted Republicans talking, affirming Davis's. Davis calls him, says he's very bipartisan. He's going to go to D.C. He's not going to vote party line. He will not support Nancy Pelosi for either Speaker or Minority Leader, and that he wants to reach across the aisle and work with Republicans. And Tim's story the other day quoted a couple of former Republican Kansas legislators who said, that's the kind of guy Davis is. And so I think just his political profile, if you will, as a moderate Democrat willing to work across the aisle might be appealing to voters in this election year.
Well, I want to ask you about Nancy Pelosi, who you mentioned. She seems to loom large over this race.
Races all over the country.
Right. And from the perspective of both sides of the campaign,
exactly.
That's the interesting part. So so let's consider the TV ads. Here's one that came out, I think, in the last week in support of Paul Davis.
We have a dysfunctional Congress. The place is broken. And when something is broken, it needs new leadership. I will not support Nancy Pelosi. Democrats and Republicans have to work together. I'm willing to work with anybody who wants to get things done.
That's from his camp. But then there's this one released by the Republican-supporting Super PAC, the Congressional Leadership Fund. Let's hear a clip from that.
Failed liberal politician Paul Davis is at it again, but this time he's running for Congress, and this time he's not alone. Now Nancy Pelosi and her Washington Democrats are bankrolling his campaign because Davis's record in Topeka is the Pelosi agenda in Washington.
All right, Tim Carpenter, Nancy Pelosi just can't win for losing. Everybody hates her.
Yeah, it's surprising to learn that Nancy Pelosi's on the Kansas ballot.
Yeah.
Somebody needs to tell Chris Kobach about that, the double voting. But there, the attacks on Davis to try to define him early in this general election will be large and loud. And they have tried to do two things with the attack ads. They've tried to connect Paul Davis to Nancy Pelosi, who's viewed in Kansas in kind of toxic terms. They've also challenged the notion that Davis has put out there that he can be a bipartisan if elected to Congress. I think Jim mentioned a couple of things about Davis that suggest he could be a bipartisan congressman. One of the things that we should recall is that when he ran for governor in 2014, more than 100 Republican politicians endorsed his candidacy, his Democratic candidacy for governor against the incumbent governor, Sam Brownback.
And he still fell short.
He did.
Jim, this week, the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, dumped $300,000 into ads supporting Paul Davis. It sounds like this is we're setting this up to be kind of an epic battle.
Yeah, and this is a race very much on the national scene. The Super PAC that connected to retiring House Speaker Paul Ryan in Washington is weighed in with hundreds of thousands of dollars paid for one of the ads we just heard. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, is weighing in on Paul's behalf because this is a toss-up race nationally, and it's one. Most of these toss-up races across the country, as you hear pundits talk about the Democrats retaking the U.S. House, most of these races are taking place in districts that either Hillary Clinton won and that Republicans now serve in Congress, or it was a narrow defeat, narrow win by Trump in those districts. But in this case, Trump won this district pretty handily, so it wasn't initially on anybody's radar screen. And yet, because of the strength of the Democratic candidate and the fact that he won the district in the gubernatorial race, it's now gradually occurred to people that this could be a very competitive race, and there's a lot of money coming in. I should mention that DCCC ad goes after Steve Watkins on many of the same issues we discussed earlier in the program.
Yeah, and Tim Carpenter, the emphasis has been on the willingness to not be beholden to Nancy Pelosi. What is Paul Davis campaigning on? positively. I mean, if it's not about conservative family values, as Steve Watkins has articulated, if it's not about getting tough on immigration, what is Paul Davis really campaigning on, apart from not being beholden to Pelosi?
So I think there's the general platitudes that you normally hear, common sense to Washington, Washington is broken, as you heard on that ad. That's one of his main themes. I think he wants to bring a rational approach to D.C. In Kansas, he ran for governor as very much a pro-public education candidate. It's reasonable, fair tax policy. I think you would find him butting heads with the agenda of President Trump on a regular basis in D.C.
But, of course, Jim McLean, the same support for education in a Kansas context allows Republicans to portray Paul Davis as a typical tax and spend liberal because he wanted to spend more money.
Which they are, and that's exactly what those ads say, as you just heard. Right? The other things I think Paul is, he's out there pretty openly talking, criticizing the tax cuts that the Republicans and President Trump pushed through Congress, you know, saying what you would expect him to say, that they benefited mainly wealthy Americans and corporations. And he also was very quick to jump on some of the trade issues, some of the tariff issues, which I think in Kansas, those are important issues to farmers. The second district isn't exactly like the first district, which is all ag land, wheat growing country, but there's still plenty of agriculture in the second district. And so I think that's also an issue that Davis is attempting to capitalize on.
Tim Carpenter, is there polling in this district? Do we have any sense of how this is going?
So I think there would be some internal polling, but nothing that anybody's been willing to share with me. I'm not sure how accurate polling this far out from the election would be, how useful it would be. I think people are a little bit exhausted from the primary and are trying not to think about this kind of stuff.
It's really true of the journalists I know, yes. as far as I can tell. Well, that's Tim Carpenter of the Topeka Capital Journal, Jim McLean of our own Kansas News Service. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
Yeah, happy to do it.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll move from the drama of Kansas politics to drama on the screen, including the stories of a woman who finds her only joy in jigsaw puzzles, of a French safecracker framed for murder, and much more. It's our monthly roundup of indie, foreign, and documentary films, so don't go away. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, the latest on the deliberations over this year's Farm Bill. It's a massive piece of legislation that will affect millions. You can listen back to that program at kcur.org/up-to-date. Steve's back on Monday for a conversation about working and parenting with KSHB's Rhiannon Alley and Mike Maruzars. Tune in on Monday for that. A child with Down syndrome, another who is a dwarf, one who commits a crime, a lesbian child forced into conversion therapy, a German singer's struggle with addiction. This month's crop of independent and documentary and foreign films shows us how well and sometimes how badly parents and fans deal with those who are seen as somehow imperfect or different. Joining us, as always, is our perfect collection of film critics, film professor Cindy Haynes. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, good morning.
Veteran critic Steve Walker. Hi, Steve.
I'm here. Thank you.
And Bob Butler, who is the longtime film reviewer for the Kansas City Star. Bob, hello.
Doing fine.
Good to see you. So it's good to be back with you all, by the way.
Thank you, Brian.
It's been a while. Let's jump right in. There's a whole lot of movies coming out here this week, starting with one about a timid wife and mother whose world is confined to the kitchen, the laundry room, and the church, who finds her joy in puzzling. Cindy, tell us about Puzzle.
Well, it's a very pleasant surprise, a delightful movie. A woman named Agnes has no confidence. She has no life, and she's taken for granted by her family. And then she discovers a jigsaw puzzle, which was one of two gifts that were given to her on her birthday. She had to bake her own birthday cake even. Mm-hmm. And one was an iPhone, and she said she had absolutely no use for that. And the other was a jigsaw puzzle. And from that point on, her life takes a turn for the better.
We're going to hear a little bit of this movie. What are we hearing?
Yes. This is Agnes's bully of a husband, Louis, bullying Agnes.
All right. Let's take a listen.
Where's dinner?
I guess I forgot.
You forgot about dinner? What else you forget about? You forget about us?
I'm sorry. Just be a minute.
Did you buy my cheese? Did you forget about that too?
I did.
You think this is funny? What's wrong with you?
Come on, Dad.
No, I slave all day for this family. I come home and you're making puzzles?
Look, I'm gonna make dinner for everyone, okay? Dad, just go upstairs and take a shower. I'll take care of it.
No, this is bull.
If you leave now, don't come back.
And yet, her husband and her two grown sons love her to death. They do take her for granted. And then when her life takes a turn by meeting somebody she's going to compete with in a national jigsaw puzzle competition, she realizes what a nice distraction people who don't take her for granted are.
Yeah, the guy, the puzzle champion she teams up with is played by, his name is Irfan Khan. And I don't know if he's Pakistani, Indian, Afghani or what, but he's one of the world's great actors as far as I'm concerned. If you look at his credits, if you look at any of his past work, this guy's amazing. And basically, he's the illicit romantic interest. You can smell that coming a mile away, mm-hmm. right? The thing about this movie is not that it surprises you with things you didn't expect. It's that it gives you what you expect, but the two main performers are so compelling, you totally get into it. And I have to say this, as the husband, David Denham negotiates one of the trickiest roles in the movie because he has to show love for this woman, but he still has to show that he's a bit of a, you know, redneck, he's a garage mechanic. And his ability to transverse that without turning the guy into a total heavy is quite amazing.
When I first started watching the film, I was thinking, when is this set? Is this the 1950s? Mark Turtletaub, the director, did a fantastic job of evoking an era, although it's set in contemporary times.
We haven't mentioned that Kelly MacDonald plays Agnes, so she gives a very nice, sweet performance.
If we remember her from Boardwalk Empire.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's Puzzle. It opens today at Liberty Hall and Tivoli and the Fine Arts Theater, too. So let's move on to Papillon. And, Bob, this is a movie about a French safecracker who's framed for murder and then determined to escape from a penal colony.
Yeah, this falls into the who thought this was a good idea category. The first Papillon movie, it was based on a best-selling book in the 60s, was in 1973. It's about a French safecracker who is sent to a hellish French penal colony in the Caribbean, Africa? I don't know exactly where it is.
Devil's Island.
Something like that. Yeah. And he escapes. He has a big butterfly on his chest tattooed, and that's why he's known as Papillon. In the original, back then, he was played by Steve McQueen. I have my problems with the original movie, but Steve McQueen is Steve McQueen, and that tells you a lot right there. Watching Steve McQueen trying to escape is, all right, relatively compelling. This time, Papillon is played by Charlie Hunnam, who most people probably know from TV's Son of Anarchy. He's a British actor who oozes the kind of, you know, hunky charisma, but he's also got skills as an actor. And
underline that.
And there are moments in this movie with his shaved head. He's a blonde. He looks uncannily like Steve McQueen, which is eerie.
Mm-hmm.
The original movie teamed McQueen with Dustin Hoffman playing a safecracker. He was the guy who was always going to get beat up unless he had a tough guy to protect him. And in this case, that character is played by Rami Malek, who's best known as TV's Mr. Robot. Here's a scene. I think this is Papillon being arrested back in Paris.
I'm here for the ring.
All right, I'm coming.
It's him.
You're under arrest for the murder of Roland Legrand.
What are you talking about?
Well, he was murdered last night. A witness identified you. The pimp, Roland Legrand. You know him, right?
You got the wrong guy, pal. I was with her all night.
Come on, let's go.
All right, let me get dressed.
No. We got some stripes at the station for you, pretty boy.
Listen, I didn't kill anyone.
He was with me.
And now, relax. They got nothing.
Nobody believes on her.
And then,
get back
honestly,
in your room.
I'll be back in no time.
Poppy! Poppy!
Don't worry.
It is kind of that chaotic and violent as that clip sounded throughout. The only scene I really cared for, again, asking why are they remaking this, is when the prisoners are watching the old original King Kong. I love when old movies show up in these weird contexts.
Well, I mean, the escape movie is a pretty tried and true
tradition.
Genre,
absolutely,
right? Does this live up to the standard?
It adds nothing to the genre.
No, I didn't think so either. They spent a lot of money on this sucker. There's this huge prison, and they're like, you know, thousands of slave convicts building pyramids, all that business. But sorry.
No one's going to make a plea for Papillon.
No, it's not on any of our three to see's today.
Very good. Which we will remind our listeners, you can hear the three to see from all of our guests. You can read them online at kcur.org later today. Let's move on to Far From the Tree. Steve, this is a documentary about how families adapt to children who weren't born perfect, and it opens today.
It's based on a book by Andrew Solomon, whose 900-page book followed... He interviewed families, the parents mostly, of children whose identities or abilities aren't what they had hoped.
It was a very powerful book.
Very powerful. Yeah. And you could not possibly do a 900-page book. But what they did do was follow one family from the book, a family with a grown adult son who has Down syndrome. They also do, Andrew Solomon talks about coming out to his family and how badly that went. They talk to a little person and her husband. They talk to a family of an autistic, a son with autism, which is shattering.
Yeah.
And a family whose teenage son murdered an 8-year-old. So, I mean, just wrap your head around that. Yeah, you don't expect any of these things when you get the news
that you're
about to have a baby.
Well, let's listen to a little bit, maybe get our heads around how this documentary sounds. This is a clip from Far From the Tree.
I had dated some average-height people and tried to stay open-minded about it, but I just found that they didn't get me. And I don't know that there's anyone that gets me the way he does. I love his dwarfism. That's something that we say, like, I like your ism.
Coffee improves my quality of life.
Yeah. You know, there's certain characteristics involved with every type of dwarfism. And for achondroplasia, it's having bigger hips. And so Joe will walk up to me in a public space and whisper in my ear, I like your ism, meaning he likes my ass.
They're a delightful couple. They really are. And if you don't walk out of that movie more sensitive to the concerns of handicapped individuals, then, you know.
In terms of technique, this is an absolutely cut-and-dried, run-of-the-mill movie. But the subject matter is so overwhelmingly emotional, you cannot help but be bowled over by it.
Yeah, I mean, even the trailer is a tearjerker.
It's something. It's something, man. It's wonderful.
Someone said, I'd like to turn my kid in for a better model. But I can't.
Yeah. And what do you do? How do you cope? How does your life change from one day to the next?
A lot of honesty in those statements to camera. Well, that's Far From the Tree. It opens today at the Tivoli. Let's move on to another film. This one opened last week. It's called McQueen, not to be confused with Steve McQueen.
right.
But Steve, not McQueen, tell us about this documentary.
Well, this is about Alexander McQueen, who, if you know fashion industry at all, know that he was one of the rising supernovas that flamed out. He was a brilliant designer, British, made the strangest, weirdest clothes. One season, his line was called Highland Rape. Mm. And he used tartans and plaids.
And women in torn clothing.
He was very controversial. I think brilliant. I got to see the show Savage Beauty at the Metropolitan Museum, which was a huge hit for them at the Costume Institute.
500,000 people saw that exhibit. 500,000.
But it was a troubled life.
Troubled life. Sad life. But watching him work, watching a true artist at work, is what makes this movie superb.
What are we going to hear from the film?
We're
going to
hear... a woman, probably a fashion editor, reviewing one of his recent shows, and then him talking about what his intentions were.
All right, this is from McQueen.
His first shows were unbelievable. I mean, people were winded by them. People walked out. Quite a few acerbic reviews. But everything else before paled into comparison.
I don't want to do a show that you walk out feeling like you've just had Sunday lunch. I want you to come out either feeling repulsed or exhilarated, as long as it's an emotion. If you leave without emotion, then I'm not doing my job properly.
He's a compelling figure, and it's eerie because there's almost two of him. As a young man, he was pudgy and he had longish hair, and he was huggable. And then he lost a lot of weight and got gaunt, and it got a little bit scary.
As he got more and more famous and took over Givenchy and another line, I'm not seeing it in my notes.
Oh, Givenchy.
Gucci.
Gucci. Yeah, I mean,
those are big names.
Big gigs.
Right. Yeah. But he says about his clothes, I'm taking the horrors out of my soul and onto the catwalk.
What do you walk away from this film with?
Staggered by his genius and sad by his short life.
All right, so that's McQueen, opened last week, playing at the Fine Arts Theater. And let's move on to Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood. You know, you guys give me these descriptions, and every week there's at least one of them where I say they didn't really make a movie about 94-year-old Scotty Bowers, pimp to the stars. Did they, Cindy?
Yes, they certainly did. He wrote a salacious tell-all book, which was published in 2012, I guess it was. And I do doubt that he told... all that was to be told.
It's a lot of years to tell about, anyway.
Right. And we're talking about Rock Hudson, Katherine Hepburn, Clark Gable, Spencer Tracy, Cole Porter, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, J. Edgar Hoover, and Cary Grant.
You know, this guy, at 93, he reveals that he had three ways with both Cary Grant and Randolph Scott and Lana Turner and Ava Gardner. I mean, is he your hero or what?
Now, do we believe him?
We don't. And this is the interesting thing about the movie. They don't challenge him on any of this. Some of the names he gives you, you go, well, yeah, that figures. I've seen that guy's movies. I believe it.
Right.
But here's the deal. He ran a gas station in Hollywood, and it was basically a mix and match for gay men looking for action. He didn't charge anything. He thought it was a public service.
So you're suggesting that this is not necessarily a true story. But it's the story that he told.
I think it's accurate.
I think it's probably pretty. I think it's pretty accurate, although the movie does not go out of its way to prove it one way or the other.
We're going to hear a little bit of it, which I imagine has been censored to some degree.
What is it we're hearing? Writer William Mann is talking about Scotty.
All right. This is from Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood.
It wasn't until I started working my book on Katherine Hepburn. I was talking to some of the other biographers. And they said to me, you know, there's this character out there that you really should try to talk to. And his name is Scotty Bowers. And he had this gas station. And he, you know, he supplied men and women to the various Hollywood stars. He knows all about that era. But, you know, you'll never get to talk to him. I began to think that maybe he was an urban legend. You know, there was no Scotty Bowers.
But alas, there was. No.
And the timing is interesting because in the 50s, late 50s, anti-gay panic started to set in, thanks to Confidential magazine, which was like the Inquirer at the time, and started to get wind of Tab Hunter's life and Rock Hudson's, and Hollywood did everything it could do to keep those stories hidden, but Scotty found a job.
Yeah, he did.
Now, the interesting thing is that Scotty is the only one around to tell about the skeletons in the closet.
And no one can challenge them if they aren't true.
Exactly.
Well, no, a lot of the celebrities have gone on, but he does reconnect with two of the guys who, when they were in college, worked for him, also doing what he was doing.
And here's an absolutely incredible factoid. He was one of Alfred Kinsey's prime subjects for his book on the sexuality of males.
Interesting. Well, all right. If that's your thing, call to check in on
it's wildly
Scotty
entertaining.
The Secret History of
Well, if you're an NPR listener, it is
right,
your thing.
Right. Everyone's... Yeah, let's move on. But a different story, very different story. The Miseducation of Cameron Post. This one's based on a young adult novel back from, 25 years ago. It's the drama surrounding a young girl forced to undergo gay conversion therapy, Steve.
Yes, which is a practice that when parents were panicked by their own children's homosexuality, they would send them to these places that I think are much fewer and far between than they used to be.
Because illegal in some states. Yeah.
They have been found to be not only worthless, but psychologically damaging to gay kids as they try to pray the gay away, in so many words. And Chloe Grace Moritz does a fine job as a teenager who is sent to this camp.
And this isn't a documentary. This is a story based on such a camp. And we don't have a clip from it, but tell us more about it.
Well, Jennifer Ely is a fabulous actress. Usually she's warm and cuddly and very fascinating. Here she's a monster.
Mm-hmm. She runs Nurse Ratched.
Nurse Ratched. She runs the camp that she founded based on her brother's homosexuality, which she claims she changed him out of. And it's kind of harrowing. I mean,
it is.
It's not so. Somebody at work asked me, "Is it so just depressing?" I said, "No."
Well, here's the thing.
No, without spoiling anything, it's not depressing.
In a way, it's kind of like Papillon. It's a resistance movie.
Oh,
the kids
wow,
are
nice.
Forced to come clean, and they find ways not to tell this therapist what she wants to hear without giving up too much of their soul in the process.
Right.
And the trailer shows that this is not all a depressing story. There's a lot of laughter.
There's a lot of humor and bonding with the kids and
Moretz actually has two gay brothers, and so she was very anxious to work in this project. And she describes it as a queer movie made by queer people for queer people.
There you go.
All right.
Well,
sounds good.
It's playing at the Tivoli.
And Steve, we talked a little bit about this before. There's another movie coming out, Boy Erased. And Lucas Hedges plays a young man who's sent to a Christian gay conversion camp, and it's with Nicole Kidman and Russell Crowe. So we'll
be hearing about that in the future, probably.
Right.
Let's move on then to Nico, which Nico 1988, which is screening at the Screenland. It's about the last 2 years of that German singer Nico's life, and Cindy, it's a sad story.
It's a set, but it's absolutely—it's one of my favorite movies that we've watched over the past month. And this Danish actress Trine Dyrholm plays Nico Krista Pafken. I'm butchering these Norwegian names, but she does her own singing in this movie. And I am a huge fan of biopics, and I think she's up there with Marion Cotillard as Edith Piaf.
Yeah, this is not a nice, huggable character.
No.
Heroin addict, mean to her people.
She's the lead singer of the Velvet Underground with Lou Reed and ran with Warhol and that whole group. But this is the last couple years of her life, her last tour, where she's been through the ringer.
And she's trying to break away from, I was the girl that banged the tambourine on a bunch of songs. Yeah, it's a really devastating portrait.
Well, then we will encourage folks, if they want to know more about Nico, to go check it out at the Screenland. Let's move on to Black Klansman, a film that's gotten a fair amount of press already.
The movie of the hour, to say the least.
Certainly is. And Bob, of course, as folks probably know, it's about an African-American policeman going undercover in the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, it's based on the real story of Ron Stallworth, who worked for the Colorado Springs Police Department. Here's the thing with this movie. This movie hits all the right buttons in a cultural sense. It comes along at the right time with the right message. Right now, racism, the Klan is suddenly back in the headlines, basically, or at least white nationalists are. And so Spike Lee and one of his co-writers, local guy Kevin Wilmot, have come up with a story that's part satire, part drama. Here's the thing. For me, it is an important cultural statement. It makes its points and gets them done. It's not as satisfying as drama. Your turn?
My turn is I hated every minute of this movie, and it was the most unpleasant 2 hours I've experienced this year. I don't find white nationalist or racist funny, and they are written and portrayed and
buffoons.
As buffoons, and there were other co-critics laughing at the screening, which I also felt sickened by.
That's a minority view, though. This film seems to get really positive reviews.
I don't care if my feelings are they're not minority. People hate racists, and I do too. I don't think they're funny.
We're going to hear a little bit of the film. What are we hearing?
Well, this is Ron Stallworth talking to his chief of police about his plan to infiltrate the Klan.
How do you propose to make this investigation?
Well, I've established contact and created some familiarity with the Klansmen over the phone. I'll continue in that role, but I'll need another officer. Surprise, surprise, a white officer to play me when they meet face to face.
That's my point exactly.
Chief, black Ron Stallworth over the phone, white Ron Stallworth face to face, so there becomes a combined Ron Stallworth.
Can you do that?
I believe we can with the right white man. We can do anything.
Cindy Haynes, you want to break this tie?
Kevin Wilmot deserves tremendous credit for he's working in the upper echelons right now of filmmaking, and of American filmmaking. And I personally think that Spike Lee is one of the great filmmakers that this country has produced.
I agree with that.
You just don't like
this. I hate this movie. Yeah.
But he was told that it's not a history lesson or a comedy. And I think as a result, we don't have...
It's not quite anything, especially.
Right.
Yeah.
It's no Get Out.
And it's a little heavy-handed.
Oh, gosh, yes.
So you've heard a range of views on Black Klansman, which is, of course, playing in a lot of theaters now. Let's move on to Eighth Grade. Bob, this is a story about a 13-year-old girl trying to navigate the world of Snapchat. I feel like I might have something to learn here.
One of my favorite films, one of my favorites of the year. It was made by Bo Burnham, who is all of 27 or 28 right now. So he remembers a bit about adolescence. This is a movie you go to and you wince through half of it. And then in the second half, as our poor beleaguered heroine starts, good things start happening to her. It warms up and it actually ends sending you out feeling pretty damn great. But few films have been so brutally honest about what it's like to be an outsider in a middle school.
Ah, well, some of us don't need a film to tell us about that. But just the same, why don't we listen to a little bit of Eighth Grade?
This is her and her dad. He's trying to do dinner conversation.
All right.
I said one more week of eighth grade, right?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, huh?
I can't believe you're going to be in high school.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
I don't know.
You excited?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, I'm very excited. I'm so excited.
That is a very realistic conversation.
That is young Elsie Fisher, who is a marvel.
She's terrific. Josh Hamilton's great as her father.
And what makes her great is that, you know, she's a real person. She's got troublesome complexion. She's got a tummy on her. She, you know, it just makes her feel like an outsider. The dad, Josh Hamilton, gives one of the greatest pep talks at the end of this movie I have ever heard in my life.
It's a beautiful movie, and it's a great script.
So yeah, a few cliches along the way, you know, the mean girl, the cool guy show up, but...
They're out there.
there's nothing fictional about any of that. That's called Eighth Grade. That's been open for most of the month at a few theaters around town. Before we bring this to a close, there are some things coming up that we want to make sure folks know about, and one of those, Cindy, is the Latin American Film Festival.
Right, and also don't forget, Steve, the
Screenland Armor opens its third screen this weekend, and so they're expanding, which is great because they show a lot of our films.
Yeah.
We'll have even more to talk about then. And what do we need to know about the Latin American Film Festival?
It's being hosted at the Rio Theater, and there will be four Saturday shows beginning September the 1st.
They've been doing this for how many years?
27
Unbelievable.
Years.
Unbelievable.
So yeah.
And they're
worth
free.
Your time.
They're free.
Oh, are they?
So it's a chance to see films from Latin America.
Are they all in English or subtitled?
They're in their original language, but subtitled. Yeah.
All right. So how do folks get tickets to that?
Contact the Fine Arts Group on the internet, and we have some great movies coming up here: The Bookshop, Juliet Naked, Love Gilda, The Wife. These are all films we're going to be talking about. In a few weeks down the road.
And so you'll have to come back. Yes. Cindy Haynes, Steve Walker, and Bob Butler are film critics. They'll be back next month with the latest in documentary and independent and foreign films. Thanks to all of you.
Take care.
Yesterday on the program, we took a deep dive into the relationships between two American presidents and the men who are prosecuting them or investigating them. Here are Trump-Clinton comparisons at kcur.org/uptodate. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. I'm at ptsbrian. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Join us again Monday. Steve Kraske will be back in this chair, and he'll sit down with one of Kansas City's most visible couples, KSHB's Rhiannon Alley and Mike Maruzars. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Suzanne Hogan, Genevieve Desmarteau, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Brian Ellison. Have a great weekend, everybody. And you are up to date.